next month, Anchorage residents and visitors get a chance to watch as many movies as they want, and most of them would simply be unavailable without the Anchorage International Film Festival. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The festival brings the world of film to Alaska. But what about bringing the world of Alaska to film? Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free, that's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call, 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. It's veteran Alaska filmmakers today on Alaska, Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Well, it was so much fun last year when they did the Anchorage International Film Festival and somebody called up and said, hey, can we get a little publicity for this? And we ended up having a fascinating discussion. And it develops that down through the months, we often even talk about some of the films that show up at the festival. So to put a little different light on it this time around and talk about the movie business and where it's been and where it's – nobody knows where it's going. We've asked a couple of Alaska filmmakers who have worked here for a long time to be our guest and kind of tell a few war stories maybe and discuss what it takes and where it might go. Start, I guess, with Jeffrey Silverman. Jeff, how you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here. And looking forward to the festival.
Yeah.
I've missed the last couple because I've been out of town, and so I'm glad I'm going to be here and just go and just keep going and going and seeing a lot of films.
Well, Jeff, what's your project you're working on now?
I'm working on a one-hour documentary for PBS called For the Rights of All, Ending Jim Crow in Alaska. And the title pretty much explains what it's about. It's about the civil rights story that we had here in Alaska, culminating in the passage of the Anti-Discrimination Act of 1945. So there's some history, some reenactment, and interviews, and what it means to people today.
And that was, we should point out, I think, 19 years before Congress passed the National Civil Rights Act.
And I think more significantly, 10 years before Brown versus Board of Education, which also ended segregation in that respect.
So this is a project. It'll end up on public television, and I guess that's a venue for, you know, a significant venue for filmmaking. How long have you been working in Alaska now?
I've been in Alaska since, I don't know if I want to admit this, but I came up in 1983, but I haven't been working in film exclusively during that time, of course.
Oh, I know. You came to one of our radio workshops, I remember.
Years ago. Wow. And I actually did a story, too.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's a KSKA story because I did a little thing on the Oscar Anderson House, and my wife-to-be had heard it, and when we met, it was just a couple of weeks after that had aired, and she go, she says, you're Jeff. I just heard, didn't I hear you on the radio? And I was like, with great aplomb, yes, that was me.
What was it? It was a good piece, and you really showed a great deal of talent. I saying as someone that's trained a lot of people, because you were able to capture so many different sounds of that creaky old house down there.
Yeah, that was the best part of it.
The
old toilet and everything.
And
that's what impressed me the most.
But I suppose a little background in filmmaking helped you to, imagine what scenarios and so forth like that.
Sure.
Well, it's great. It's great to have you here. In a little bit, I want to get you to tell your film festival story, but I want to turn to Larry Golden. Larry, welcome to Anchorage.
Hi there.
you were Juneau based for years and years.
That's true. While I was living there, I got the opportunity to produce a series down in Florida. Winter was looming on the horizon, so I grabbed it and went down there and did that. When I was through with that, My wife, Jacqueline Estes, the beautiful Jacqueline Estes, was offered a job in Anchorage. And I joke that, you know, in this business, you got to follow your meal ticket wherever it is. We decided it was right for us to be in Anchorage. Her elderly mother was here, and she wanted to be close to her. So I moved here in 2001 and have been here since.
Would you say that filmmaking is an industry, if you choose a career in the film industry, it might be best to have a domestic partner with a day job?
Yeah. It's always any economic stability you can find in your life will help. This is it's kind of a feast and famine business, at least the way that I do it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know what your filmography would be, but I would imagine it would be a kind of a lengthy list. But I do know you've done Nova, right? Can you tell me a little bit?
No, I haven't done any Novas. I've done a couple of National Geographic specials. I've worked on feature films. I worked on John Sayles' film that he shot in Alaska, Limbo. And I was the executive producer for a feature film that was produced in Alaska, 30 years ago now, Spirit of the Wind, which was the film based on the life of George Atla. And I've worked in national commercials as well as, shooting for out-of-state clients who need something done, who are either going to be here and want to hire a local crew to shoot for them.
You're a second unit man.
Yeah, and then on some occasions, they just have hired me to go out and field produce and shoot something for them and send it back. And then, of course, they're the films that I produce and direct myself and usually wind up shooting and or editing some portion of it. Most of it, actually.
Okay. You have to really be a jack of all trades if you're going to produce in Alaska. You just really have to know how to do everything.
Well, I would think,
and
a bit of a mechanic too, because what if stuff doesn't work and you're out on location?
That's right. You have to improvise and gaffer tape.
Always.
Yeah, I think Jeff hit the nail on the head because when I got into the business, somebody asked me, "Well, why are you doing this in Alaska?" And I said, "Well, because I love living in Alaska, and this is the place to do it." And they said, "Well, wouldn't you be better off if you were based in New York or Los Angeles?" And probably I would get more work, probably higher budgeted work, but you tend to get pigeonholed into one specialty or another. You're either a cameraman or shooter, they say now, an editor, a writer, director, whatever, and out of necessity, I've had to learn, and Jeff's had to learn, and probably everybody in this business has had to learn just about every aspect of the business. So, you do become a utility player, and it's broadened my experience. And in some cases, there's a saying in the business, or an idea in the business that you can't really edit if you don't know how to shoot, and you can't shoot mm-hmm. if you don't know how to edit, which is to say that there are two sides of telling a story visually, and more experience at one makes you better at the other, because you can shoot, as a cameraman, you can shoot with an understanding of what an editor is going to need to put together a visual story. As an editor, you see the footage and you try to understand what was actually happening in the field when it was being shot, what the story really was, in the reality of the situation. So as a as an editor with experience as a cameraman, you can sort of figure out what that was and you can put it together.
That's so true. I don't think anyone should direct or shoot anything until they've had a chance to edit something, and something long form, something big, something that wasn't shot very well or wasn't shot in a way that's going to be kind to the editor. And when you're screaming, at 3 a.m. in that dark editing suite,
gave me this job to work with?
Right. Then you know, and you'll remember that when you're out shooting or directing the next production.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I, you know, you get it in radio where it's like, who wrote this?
You realize it was yourself and you wrote that morning.
You go back there and say, whoops. Well, yeah, I, years ago, I experienced tremendous pigeonholing in the film industry in New York. Where I did everything from cleaning prints at a distribution house to running audio transfers back in the days when they used the Aeroflex and the cameras that had the sync pulses, and they had to take the soundtrack and put them on a sprocketed tape, basically. And I used to have to make those transfers and run them over to ABC News up the street in time for the news. There wouldn't be any film on the news if I didn't make it over there. There wouldn't be any sound on the film in the news if I didn't make it there, you know, taking a cab or running up the street or whatnot. So I hung out on the fringes of the industry, and most of the people that I knew had a screenplay, a feature, that they that sooner or later they wanted to shoot. And it was a matter of you know, finding all the parts and the budget and the money raising. And the money raising, that's one part that hasn't gone away. Maybe, like, lighting has gotten a lot easier. You know, you don't have to be so careful about your lighting because it has so much better sensitivities in the electronic media. But holy mackerel, there's still money raising, isn't there?
It's part of the thing, and it never stops.
And it's like multi-years. I mean, how long would you say from conception to completion does it take to do a major project like the one you're working on now?
Well, it really depends on the project, but for a full-length thing, it's going to be at least 4 years, 5 years, often 8, 10 years for a lot of the documentaries you see. But you should understand that most of the time, people aren't working on just that, or you'd go out of business, or it's really a young person's business in that if you're only going to be working on a documentary at a time, you have to make a living in other ways, which is another reason why, as Larry said, you have to be able to shoot when someone needs a shooter. You have to be able to produce or whatever it is. If the work is there, you go out and get that work because you have to make a living. And as a young person without kids, without other encumbrances, you can survive on the feast or famine thing. But, you know, otherwise, you're just not going to have enough to make a living.
Larry, what was it like working with John Sayles and Maggie Lorenzi when they made Limbo? I happen to think, some people just hate that movie because the end is so ambiguous. It's basically they decided not to end it. And so you're left with this awful feeling at the end of the movie that some people think is good and some don't. But what I really appreciate about Sayles is that they always bring you – they pay a whole lot of respect to the location. They research a place and they do a film that is sort of crafted around a place. And it seemed like that's what they were for in Juneau for like forever, weren't they?
Well, it was about on and off. They spent 4 months there.
Yeah.
Maggie Renzi, John's partner, does a lot of the logistical work, getting things organized, as a producer. So she may have been there even more than that. I don't know. But yes, your observation about how the story becomes about a place as much as about characters, that's very true about John's work. And working with them was really a pleasure. I mean, they're both brilliant people, and they gather around them a coterie of others who work with them on projects, several projects, over several years. So there's kind of a family atmosphere, but it's very professional. John always comes in within budget. He's a safe bet as a director that way. You know, he understands that he has an obligation to, the financiers of the project. He is one person that I've met that I can truly say is a genius. He just comes up with things. I just can't imagine where they come from, but,
he's a great story because he's able to do things on relatively low budgets, and he went off. It's not like they all came his way. You know, if you want to make films, you got it. No one's going to come to you and say, "Here's $2 million."
And that would be a small budget.
Yeah, well, or here's $300,000. Go make a movie. you take your idea and you shop it around. You write proposals. You do all this stuff, and sales went without really any preamble. Went down to Los Angeles and just kind of worked there for a while and worked it and worked it and worked it till he started to break into film. And I think I don't know if I think he said something about writing for Roger Corman, wrote a couple of screenplays, and just sort of built up from there. And
Piranhas.
Yeah,
he wrote Piranhas.
But he started off with very low budgets and just a great writing, just really really great writing and a great success story. And it's good to see an intelligent filmmaker really succeed in Hollywood. But he had to go down there. He had to go to L.A. and knuckle under.
Yeah. Well, Larry, what did they want from you? First off, it seemed they were curious. You were probably curious about Juno.
Well, I met John and Maggie at the 1988 Hawaiian Film Festival.
Oh, good point. They've been here before.
Yeah. I had a film in competition, and so did they. And I made it a point to try to meet him. And when he learned that I was from Alaska, he was very curious and wanted to know more. And we spent a lot of time talking. And then eventually, I worked with the state film office, which existed at that time, to bring him up here as a guest speaker. And he was in Anchorage for a while.
Yeah, I was at that workshop. Yeah. They had a little, like an all-day thing. Yeah. It was great.
Mary Katsky, who lives here in Anchorage, more or less put together the Anchorage leg of that trip. And then I hosted John and Maggie in Juneau. And
So they were staying in your place?
Well, they weren't staying in my place. They actually wound up staying at Joel Bennett's house, who was another filmmaker.
Small world.
Yeah. He and his wife were out of town, and
perfect.
So he arranged all that. They liked what they saw, and John just kind of absorbed, the ambiance of southeastern Alaska, and came up. Well, actually, it was like almost 10 years later that he sent me the screenplay for Limbo, and said that they were going to be coming up, and that they wanted to come up and produce it, and things took some time, and they finally found the money and they did it, and I went to work as a second unit cameraman on that.
Well, I happen to feel that it's one of the few films made in Alaska that really portrays this environment. I mean, certainly Steven Seagal didn't, Percy Adlon did in a way in Salmon Berries, but you almost can't find that movie anymore. And it's very much a Percy Adlon, through his creative process and all that. And I thought Sean Penn did a fairly decent job, but, of them all, it really, Limbo seems to express Alaska about as well as any feature film I've ever seen.
Well, I'll make a plug, for the film that I was involved in early on, Spirit of the Wind.
Ah, yes. I haven't seen it. All these years, I still haven't seen it.
Oh, gosh. Well, it was re-released several years ago under a different title, Atla. It had a theatrical run around the country. Unfortunately, it just didn't get handled properly in distribution. But my point is that it was shot with a very small crew, really almost all Alaskan crew, except for the actors, on location in Alaska in places like Rampart and Fairbanks. And it really, I think, got the flavor of the place and the time in which it was set, which is the late 1950s, which you can only do if you're actually in the place. All these films that are ostensibly set in Alaska but shot in British Columbia or Montana, they always look – I know what Alaska looks like, so those places look phony to me, or those films look phony to me. But I think, there's even another element of reality that is missing from them that – maybe the untutored audience doesn't really know what they're missing or understand it, but somehow I don't think it rings true for them either as strongly, or at least they're missing, you know, the filmmakers are missing an opportunity to put another character in the story, which is the place itself. And, you know, Sean Penn deserves a lot of credit for going to the trouble, of coming up here and dealing with the kinds of things that Alaskans have to deal with. And that aspect or those elements of the film that were shot in Alaska, look like they were shot in Alaska. And they have a feeling to them that you couldn't get any other way.
Right, mosquitoes. Because it's a character in the story.
Yeah.
That it affects the hero and you can't ignore that. And he was smart not to ignore it. But there's another film I want to mention. How can we forget Runaway Train? I mean, there were a lot of scenes shot here. and all those train scenes and everything. And that was probably the best part about that film, I think, was just the incredible shots of the train rolling along. I mean, it didn't even matter the story. It just was the craggy peaks and the snow-covered spruces and the grittiness of the story. It really fit. It was a good fit.
Let's put out the phone number here, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Where is Alaska's place in the film world of the future, I guess we'll say? And also, this one, do we need to get our film office back? Or is the time going by for all that sort of thing? I mean, we got Ice Roads and Dangerous Catch and all. I mean,
we had a film
Deadliest
off.
Catch. It seems that television has discovered Alaska and maybe more than we really wanted now. and maybe they'll be coming up here in droves like the TV crews already on the Sarah Palin binge here.
Sure. Well, and it really depends on what kind of filmmaking you're talking about. If we're talking feature filmmaking versus documentary filmmaking versus commercials, that's never slowed down. A lot of commercial work goes on up here. There's a dozen shooters, videographers who make their living just, you know, going out and shooting commercials. That's it, you know, and they're expensive commercials, and that will never stop. So a film office, a revived film office, would have to strategize what kind of things are they trying to attract. Are we just going to try to get feature films up here? I don't know. They had a film office. It may have been successful in getting one film here, White Fang, which they ended up shooting in Haines and apparently
didn't snow,
and they had to use mashed potatoes. I heard about
potato
that.
Potato flakes, yeah.
And people just never could eat instant mashed potatoes again. Not that they'd want to anyway, but because it was just all over the smell.
So you're a little ambiguous on it, I guess, is what you would say.
Well, I guess I would advocate for opening a film office, but I wouldn't want a film office spending money on, like, getting a big billboard down in L.A. Yeah. and stuff. I think that was cute, but all that money went to an agency to do all that and have a nice little campaign, and what was the payoff? But on the other hand, they published a film manual, which was every state should do this, and it's just a listing of all the film people here and services and what little infrastructure we have. It's all listed out there, and more importantly, it's updated. You know, with the new numbers, the new people that come, people that go, and it's updated every year. That costs money to do, but I think that was a great service.
Yeah. Your listeners should understand that most states have some kind of film promotion office, an entity that's usually affiliated with state government, but not necessarily, that's trying to attract producers into that area on the theory that when a film comes to your area, they're going to spend several hundreds of thousands, if not several millions of dollars in the local economy. So it's considered to be economic development. And then, of course, if the local film industry grows as a result of that, more people in the business get jobs, and that has a spin-off benefit for the economy. And the public relations value of having your state portrayed in films is valuable too, especially if you're a state like Alaska that hopes to attract the tourists. So every time you appear on the national screen, that's worth so many hundreds of visitors, really. So those are some of the economic justifications for doing that kind of thing. And actually, there is going to be more effort in that direction now. Senator Johnny Ellis sponsored a bill that was passed in the last legislative session to reinstitute at least a one-person office to do that kind of promotion and development. And there's also a provision in the bill to issue, you know, for tax credits or swappable tax credits for corporations or individuals, I suppose, who finance a production with a significant effort made in Alaska using Alaskan people and resources.
See, now there is my son's in the business and in Los Angeles, and they do commercials and, you know, whatever. And they're always pitching ideas. And he says, look, you know, I'd love to come to Alaska, but they don't have any incentives. All the other states have incentives. Alaska's got nothing.
Yeah, well, they're not going to come here unless it's part of the story.
He was saying, look, you know, if I could go shoot in West Virginia or Florida or wherever, you know, there's incentives, there's tax incentives and whatnot, but Alaska's got nothing.
No one's going to, even if you have a tax incentive, if there isn't a reason to be here, they're not going to come.
Yeah. Official reason.
It's so too expensive.
Well, you would think we had that.
It's got to be a scripted reason to be here. They're simply not going to come.
Yeah, I think Jeff's hit on it, that the story has to have elements in it that can only be achieved in Alaska. The reason Alaska is a good location and a consistent location for commercials is that it has a look or several looks, visual, you know, looks that are unique that cannot be duplicated anyplace else. You know, so if you want to film, a car on a glacier, the odds are you're going to work somewhere near Anchorage or Juneau where there are glaciers that are fairly close to road access.
Sure.
Fishing, other kinds of situations.
Star Trek
right. You're going to have to come to Alaska, right. You know, where we have all these tracks.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, Star Trek, it was set on some other planet, you know, but they used the Kinnick Glacier. They sent a second unit up here.
So you're not going to get people coming to Alaska. I mean, even if the economics were more favorable, you're not going to come, even with incentives, you're not going to get people coming to Anchorage to try to duplicate New York City. But you will get them to go to Montreal because certain parts of it look very much like New York City and you wouldn't know the difference. And with what used to be the difference in the value of the dollar, the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar, plus lots of incentives that the Canadians offered, it made economic sense to shoot it in Canada. But, for Alaska to succeed in attracting outside production, it really should be working at the story level with people who are developing stories to see how it might be possible to work in or motivate people to write stories that really are set in Alaska.
Oh, yes. Get Alaska in more screenplays.
Write more.
1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK. I think we'll go to the television and motion pictures in a moment. But first, let's take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about making movies in Alaska and putting a little spotlight on the Anchorage International Film Festival, which is coming up and has just a tremendous menu of movies. The strange thing about film festivals is you actually don't know the movies. You have to read the descriptions to figure out what's going to be good. But having gone to like three festivals now, the quality of the films is getting better and better. And these are movies that you normally just wouldn't get to see. Certainly the weird Italian science fiction thing that they had last year, you would never gotten to see. And then there's the things like the great projects that we had a guest on about earlier. Neither one of our
and the animation too. I mean,
incredible.
What great stuff!
Shorts,
animation shorts, animation,
yeah. But my guests are people who are in the film business. They make films and they do it in the state of Alaska. And they both done it a long time. Larry Golden made Spirit of the Wind, and Jeff Silverman. Yeah, go ahead, Larry.
Well, that's not correct. I was the executive producer of it. I was involved in it, but I can't take credit as the author, director, or producer.
All right. Okay, good. And Jeff Silverman has got too many projects to count, but the one I want to get into right now is you were one of the first winners of the Golden Ouzik.
Yes, the Film Festival's award. It's one of I think it's the best award in the country.
I would think Anchorage it would be
Film
highly
Festival,
coveted.
Yeah, is the Ouzik or the Golden Ouzik, and it's only a replica though, and they hand it out to winners of the various categories. And when they first started, they weren't really engaged with the local filmmaking community, and. They decided, I think it was the second or third year, that they wanted to showcase Alaska films. And I had something out that had won some awards in the festivals, and it was just a really short film about Elizabeth Paratovich. And I've since taken that and expanded it into a full length.
You're still on that one.
Yeah, still on that one. Well, you know, you got to start somewhere. It was a great promo for fundraising. But anyway, it was a little thing, and they asked me, can we show that? And we're going to show, you know, a collection of Alaska films, stuff that's out there already. And I said, okay. And I went to a bunch of films and didn't think about it again. Well, Monday morning, I get this call and someone said, congratulations. And I'm like, why? Well, you won an award. What award? You won a Golden Ouzik. You won an Ouzik award. And why? Well, apparently they had decided to give an award to the, you know, quote unquote best Alaskan film that year. Obviously nothing of Larry's was showing. I'm just a little nod of anyway, so I go, great. And they say, well, call BMAC. He's got the Ouziks, and so this is Brian McMillan, who used to work quite extensively on the film festivals and helping organize it. And
yeah, he'll probably be around for this one too.
Yeah, okay. Well, BMAC, I call BMAC and I say, I hear I won an award. And he said, yeah, but that's the good news. The bad news is someone, you know, the Ouziks are missing. We lost them. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Well, you get in trouble carrying one of those things around, you know.
Well, they had this awards banquet. I'm not a banquet guy. I don't really like them, and I wasn't invited, so...
I didn't go.
And apparently they said, here's an award for, you know, and I wasn't there. And Brian said he gave out the awards, and there were several filmmakers who weren't there. So they left them in the podium. He went and ate his banquet dinner, whatever it was, and went back up after the dinner, and they were gone. Someone had taken all the Ouziks. And to make things more interesting, he said there was a guy who had made a film about Elvis of Canada, and it was about how he was channeling Elvis. And I didn't see this film, and I don't know if it won an award, but I guess he was channeling Elvis and was quite serious about it and been abducted by aliens and Elvis's
him too?
Spirit. Yeah. his spirit had taken on Elvis and he didn't really look much like him, I guess, but he could sing like him. And he was at the banquet, and BMAC told me he left early, and perhaps Elvis took your Ouzik back to Canada. So that's my Ouzik story. Well, they gave me another one, but I've always had this idea, and I already got it copyrighted, Steve. So don't take this idea, but the idea of making a film a road trip where someone goes you know, off to Canada to find Elvis to get back your golden Usyk, you know, Jason and the golden Usyk or something like that.
You could get a UFO worked in there real easily, too.
That's true.
Man, that sells movies.
If I got money for it, I would shoot in Alaska, I promise.
Speaking of selling movies, William is with us from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, William.
Good morning. I heard you talk about incentives for movies. Another word, I guess, would be subsidies. But I'll pass on that. And I have two questions. One is with regard to a movie, I believe Desi Arnaz Jr. was the star and was the vehicle for him, but apparently the plot line or story involved the Trans-Alaska pipeline construction.
From some
gambling debt or something and flees up there. I wonder if you could discuss that or talk about it.
We'll see if either one of our guests knows anything about it. I know Desi Arnaz Jr. was in this band, Dino Desi and Billy. I remember that. Yeah, Gloria Stavers used to promote that those guys. I remember that. So they tried to have a future in rock and roll, but I didn't really know about this future in the motion picture industry or television, and neither one of our guests knows a thing about it.
I have another question, though.
Okay, go ahead.
I was curious about the Desi Arnaz vehicle and the Trans-Alaska pipeline construction because I had worked on it. I had also worked on a construction project in Imonac at the Yukon Delta, and while I was working there in the course of the summer, I had a chance to observe the traditional Yupik drumming. I think it's Leonard Kamerling produced a documentary about it, I think called Winter Drums, and I was very interested to see some of the dancers and drummers that I had witnessed when I had worked there, but I hadn't understanding of the role these dancing and drumming played in Yupik culture. I wasn't familiar with the culture, being a Gusik, a white man. And I wonder if you could talk about the Kamerling's documentary. So I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Okay.
Well, Lenny Kamerling has been making films in Alaska for a long time. He's currently based out of the University of Alaska Museum. That's where he's located physically. And he's the curator of film. That's his official title. For the museum, but he's still making films, and that's a way that you might be able to locate him in particular. But he and his partner at the time, Sarah Elder, did a whole series of films with and about Alaska Natives, mostly in northern and northwestern Alaska. And I say with in addition to about, because they really involved the people in the community in the process of making the film and planning the film, and they showed them rough cuts of the film and got responses from them. So, to an extent more so than normally, you know, the subjects of the film were involved in crafting the film. And I think you bring up a point there that's very interesting and special about Alaska. You know, in that for a place with a small population like this, we have an unbelievably active local production community. Lots of people doing these kinds of things at a variety of different, you know, levels of sophistication and expense, but still a lot of work getting done. And one of the really important and valuable things that is being done and has been done is documenting Alaska Native lifeways. There's a tradition that goes, you know, back into the 1920s and 1930s with Father Hubbard, who filmed Eskimo people, and then continues to this day. So a lot of, there's a lot of visual history about how certain subsistence skills are practiced and taught, and crafts, and then, of course, dancing and drumming and singing, such as, you know, the caller referenced. So those things are exist in the archives at the University of Alaska Film Archive in Fairbanks. It's actually called the Alaska Film Archives, but it's affiliated with the Rasmussen Library. And then AMIPA, the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association here in Anchorage, do a great job in a very difficult environment, of physically preserving these films so that they are a historical record that people can look at, and people like Jeff and myself can often use some of that material in our projects.
And also be aware that we're experiencing a cultural renaissance, especially in music and dance and drumming among the Alaska Native peoples. And it's still happening now. It's more adapted to the stage in some respects, from what I've seen. But there's still filming going on, and this is the other part of the archival equation, is that we continue to document. Can't assume that well, it's already been done. You have to continue to film with this, to work with the dance groups and understand and record how they're doing, because they come up with new dances, and there's a lot of groups out there, and they all come to Anchorage every year, or Fairbanks, for the AFN convention. And AFN has a 2 or 3 night dance festival with groups from every region of the state, and it's an incredible evening, because they always make sure that you get one representing the different cultural groups, the major cultural groups. And that AFN has been broadcasting Koyaanisqatsi since 1983, since the very first one, and it's become a very sophisticated broadcast, and you can see what's happening right now if you had tuned in. And I know this because I produce and direct the broadcast, but we record it as well, and
so
do the best job.
Yeah, you're
we
getting
can.
Down to a fairly valuable archive now.
Yeah, there's years of it, and the footage is there, and I can't say enough about the importance of these archives and storing it and adapting it to the new formats as the formats change, so it's always accessible to whoever needs it.
Well, I want to bring up the snow dance aspect, I think, of the festival at this point. These are the Alaska films that are included in the group, and I'll just give a couple of highlights. I just was looking over the program. And they've got one called X and Time, 4 minutes. A wannabe film mogul in Alaska discovers a charismatic, talented alien and grooms him for stardom, only to have his protege wooed away by big-time Hollywood muscle. 4 minutes.
That happened to me.
Yeah. As you were searching for
Elvis.
He
stole your story.
Sikumi on the Ice. This is Andrew McLean's film, 15 minutes. I believe it won an award at Sundance. And is being shown here at Snowdance at the Anchorage International Film Festival. Junk Dreams, 73 minutes. Two brothers, 77 and 76, board a 29-foot Chinese junk boat and head 1,620 miles to Valdez, Alaska, in their 2.5-month voyage. I mean, this is... This is something.
Nice variety.
And of course, there's Eating Alaska by Ellen Frankenstein. Either one of you acquainted with
her?
Yep. Yeah. It's a documentary about a vegetarian who moves to Alaska, marries a fisherman and hunter, and begins to wonder what the right thing to eat is on the last frontier.
Well,
we've got a show right there.
Well, it's great to see that it's not all just snow machines and extreme skiing in Alaska. There's so much more to document. There's so much going on, and these are good examples of that.
Yeah. So, Larry, you got a project going right now?
Yes, I do. I want to backtrack 1 second here, though, to say that about filmmaking in Alaska. The reason I do it is, A, I love living here, and B, it's full of great, interesting people and great, interesting stories. When I travel outside, if I tell somebody that I'm a filmmaker and I live in Alaska, the first thought they come to is, oh, I'm a wildlife filmmaker. I film animals, and I've done a little bit of that, but that's certainly not my
having glaciers.
People like Joel Bennett down in Juneau and Bill Bacon up here in Anchorage, have made a career of doing wonderful work like that. It's very, very difficult work to do. But for me, I find the social wildlife of Alaska, the human wildlife of Alaska, to be very fascinating and very worthwhile. So that's kind of what I've been doing, stories about people and about the history of Alaska, which I think is also very interesting.
So it must have been very strange for you to transition to Anchorage from Juneau, because it's very different cultures in those two different cities.
Well, it's true. There will always be a very warm spot in my heart for Juneau. I get back there as often as I can. Got a lot of wonderful friends down there, and yeah. It's a great place for lots of reasons. But anyway, the project I'm working on now, it's kind of coincidental that you've got two people here, Jeff and myself, who are both working on historical documentaries. But I'm doing a historical documentary right now as well. This one is on the Alaska statehood movement, which, of course, the 50th anniversary of which will be next year. And that one took about 4 years to raise the money for, and I've been in production now for about 2 years, and I'll be finishing up in a little while.
So you get to use a lot of archival stuff in there, I would assume.
Yeah, a lot of archival films and archival photographs, and then, of course, interviews with people. But I'm also filming quite a bit of material in contemporary Alaska, because part of what I want to do is relate statehood and what's happened to Alaska as a result of statehood, and maybe conjecture a little bit about how things might have been differently if we hadn't achieved statehood, although I think it would have happened, you know, ultimately under any scenario. But so those are the kinds of visual resources that you bring to a story like this.
Yeah. You know, of course, we've been working statehood stuff. That's where money is right now, I guess. but we've been working statehood stuff, and I've been doing research and doing interviews and so forth. And one thing that I found pretty astounding, and we brought it up on the show here too, is that a lot of stuff, the things that we're griping about, why they wanted Alaska to become a state, are still around. We still have the overpowering dominance of the federal government. We still have a whole lot of our fishing industry dominated out of Seattle. And we're still marginalizing our natives.
Well,
And the military is still an enormous presence in Alaska.
Well, that wasn't anything that anybody complained about.
No.
During the statehood era. Well, I mean, the basic economic factors of Alaska, you know, are pretty immutable. You know, they largely result from location, 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 and the place isn't moving. So we're going to have these issues, you know, and our resources are the same, and people are always going to feel that somehow we're not getting the best deal possible for our resources. But I think, and I think most economists and historians would agree with me that we're doing a lot better now than we did in territorial days. And as long as we're part of the United States, I hope Joe Vogler is looking down at me now. As long as we're part of the United States, there is always going to be some sort of interdependence between our state government and the federal government. You know, we will get some benefits from our association with the federal government, and we'll lose some autonomy. That's just the way it goes in the real world. And whether or not the trade-offs are worthwhile is, you know, something that anybody has to decide for themselves. But I think there's no doubt that we have more self-determination now than we had in territorial days. Are we entirely self-determinating? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. What I was saying about the military was that essentially, it was when you look at it, it was an enormous economic force back in the statehood time, because we just had the Second World War and the Cold War, and then basically military pulled out of Alaska immediately upon statehood.
Oh, that's not true.
Well, to a tremendous degree, because after Sputnik, there was missiles, and all of a sudden it wasn't about dew line and all that anymore.
Well, I'd be curious to know what others think about that.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
I mean, the presence has always been here.
No, it's not a question. It's a question of how much money was being spent by the military in Alaska that suddenly collapsed.
Well, I'm sure it got reduced greatly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go to Maya, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Maya.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, I'm calling in. I've been skirting the edge of the film world in Fairbanks for the last number of years. I teach up at UAF.
I didn't know they had a film world there.
Oh, of course we do.
I actually
helped co-produce Chronic Town, which was shot here and premiered at Sundance last year. And it's a feature film, and we're hoping to have it showing. I believe it's showing at the Anchorage Film Festival. And we're working very hard. Len Kamerling is one of my committee members, and we have submitted paperwork so that we'll be going ahead and starting a film degree program here at UAF.
That's great news.
We'll be the first in the state. And so one of the things that I'm very interested in and would be curious to see what you guys think from Anchorage point of view is where, you know, we run into this problem where students are definitely fascinated and need to be involved in film. And most of the time in my 8 years at the university, they have to leave the state in order to get the training they need and resulting in not coming back necessarily. So we're trying to kind of stop that hemorrhaging in an extent and give them opportunities to do internships like we did with Chronic Town and actually help them be on set here in the state.
Yeah, the shops are so small here, it seems. I mean, Larry's pretty much his own shop. Jeff is pretty much his own shop. We don't have like a real studio. The ad agencies are probably the closest thing. But what do you think? What can be done to give training to youngsters? I mean, if they're studying filmmaking at the university and they like Alaska as a location, and yet they end up having to go to New York or Los Angeles or someplace just for the gigs.
Well, if they're at a film school, then they can come work for a producer like Larry or myself. And there's always projects, not necessarily full-length feature documentaries, but they can go there and intern, and there's a ton of work. There's always so much to do. And it's whether or not there's some filming going on in a set for reenactment or research or all the stuff that needs to happen. But they have to be coming out of somewhere, like a film school. And this is different than a television school, because they tend to focus on news and teaching students how to be a news camera person or producer or whatever. And a good film school helps students understand how to make film. I know it sounds obvious, but it's not. And how to tell stories. How do you tell a story? And how do you tell it visually? And that's the kind of thing that only a film school can do.
Yeah.
We don't have it here.
Well, we
don't have a film school, but I think that it's important that the state of Alaska, if we want the film office to really be functional, we need to give opportunities for people to have the jobs here in town or here in the state. And that is actually part of what the film incentive program, the legislation that was passed, Senate Bill 280, I believe it was, includes an internship program, so that there will be incentives for local hire.
Oh, great.
And that's a very key portion to having a functioning film industry in the state, is really providing these opportunities and giving the students leverage. And not saying, oh, you have to come from New York in order to know something about film, but saying, oh, we could do this in state. We can train our own people. Because the truth of the matter is that the film industry is already here. Like you were saying, whether they're coming up to do a documentary or a TV episode or Sarah Palin's in town, I get the calls too and am managing to send my students out into the field on a fairly regular basis to help as production assistants or whatever, to be active in these passing industry as it comes through town. And so I think just being able to continue that development is really key.
Well, I agree with Maya it would be wonderful to have a film program in Alaska so that young people who are interested in this business can get training. Parenthetically, I mean, once upon a time, and I'm not saying this to undermine anything that Maya said, but once upon a time, there were no film schools. D.W. Griffith didn't go to a film school, and Alfred Hitchcock didn't go to a film school. But times have changed, and the business is much more entrenched, and it's much more complex. So I do believe that there really is a justified reason for having film schools, and it'd be great if that program evolves in Fairbanks. And internships are available all the time. I mean, actually, I've been looking for one or more interns, even one in the Fairbanks area, for this project that I'm working on, and quite frankly, I've had a tough time finding them.
Well, you can find me through the University of Alaska. I'll help you find a student anytime.
All right, Maya, thanks.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm thinking maybe Anchorage would be a better location, because Cal Worthington's in town with three kangaroos. It's time for a gaffer here.
Well, that's the other thing about film schools and the sort of intern infrastructure that is created with what Maya was talking about. Larry and I, when we need someone, we have to go find, and it's not easy to find and then turn.
Give me a second. I got to take a break here. Okay. We'll never get through it as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Working late? Hear Alaska News nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
We're talking with Jeff Silverman and Larry Golden. Jeff, you had the floor on film schools and actually not being able lots of times to find people to
Because there isn't a regular mechanism to find people, a call board, if you will.
Yeah.
When I was filming for some reenactment scenes for the current one I'm working on, For the Rights of All, I went through the theater companies, the professional theater companies. In Juneau, it was Perseverance Theater. In Anchorage, it was Cyrano's Theater, and to go to them for actors, and where do you cast the stuff, and where do you get the costuming and the makeup people? Well, it's in the theater. And so I went there, and once I went there, things really clicked, because they've got the connection to all of their actors and their production people and their interns. So yeah. that really worked for me, and what Maya, I think, has in mind is the same sort of network, a call board for the work that happens when it happens.
Yeah, it's spotty. I guess we'd have to say it's spotty. Larry Golden, are you carrying around a screenplay that you'd like to shoot?
Me and about 320 million other Americans.
I know that, but I want to know. Just wanted to see if you had one.
Yeah, I do. Actually, the one, there are several, but the one that's in the best shape is actually not set in Alaska, so here I'm really embarrassed to mention that.
That's all right.
No subsidies for you.
How about you, Jeff? You got a feature?
My Golden Usyk one.
You're still
starring
working
Steve.
On it.
Yeah, Steve, you can play Elvis.
I want to play the alien in the flying saucer.
I've got a few things in the burner. You can't wait. You have to just keep the plates flying.
Do you have
the
screenplay for a feature film that if somebody handed you the whatever you said $2 million that you would run out and make?
No. I don't have like in the hopper ready to hand to someone.
Right.
I just haven't had the time. Like I was saying earlier, this is not the only thing I'm working on, and there's a lot of other projects, most of which will not air. They're just somewhere to a special audience.
I feel like we're just getting started. We hardly talked about the Anchorage Festival at all.
Go to it.
Just go, yeah.
And we didn't talk about the Alaska Light, you know? I think the light in Alaska, the first thing that visitors say is this is a very special, very different kind of light. That's a resource all on its own.
Of course, yeah. And then in the summer, you have 6 hours of what's known as magic hour.
Yeah.
When the sun is low
golden
on the horizon and you get those golden, warm colors.
Well, you're saving money right there. It's Talk of Alaska. Gooseberry Peter on the controls. Ellen Locke, you're on the phones. Duncan Moon's the managing editor. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.